Welcome to Turning Pages, a series of in-depth conversations with authors about their works.
All right, well, it's an award-winning novel. Mr. Jones, Margaret Swetman joins me in studio to talk about it. How are you doing, Margaret?
I'm well, thank you.
To kind of describe the novel, I would say, you know, Cold War espionage, but kind of a mannered espionage. This is, you know, we're not talking like Dan Brown style, like very short chapters. This is more like Len Dayton or something like that, I would say.
Well, I studied a lot when I was writing it, the Jean Le Carré.
Okay, yeah. That.
And his sort of Baroque ensembles.
Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy.
Yeah, that one especially.
Yeah.
Well, I started with The Spy Who Came In From the Cold, that kind of
urgent, which is also a great movie, too.
Great movie.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I admire those two of Carré's books. I'm not so crazy about the others, but grew up on spy novels, so I didn't know it was being mannered. I think that's just my own habit of hammering at sentences.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying it in like a disparaging way. I just like it's not that frenetic paced spy thing, right? Like that there's a pacing to it, and there's a lot much more about interiority than there is action, let's say.
And do you know a movie called The Last Night? Where there's an asteroid hitting Earth.
Is it Don McKellar film? Yeah.
And I was thinking about that a lot because there's this, in that movie, there's a light that comes up extremely slowly through the whole movie.
Mm-hmm.
And when it's fully lit, it means we're doomed. And I was thinking of that, sort of that slow dawning through the book where
right.
I hope the reader would gradually figure out what was going on.
Sure enough. So it's called Mr. Jones, and I'm curious, was it your choice? Was it the publisher's choice? Like, was the title always Mr. Jones, or was there something that you'd wrestled with?
It had many, I thought in my mind it was called The Greater Good. I knew that wasn't the title, but I thought of that because I thought of the Canadian banality and how we never really have our own external affairs or foreign affairs. Policies and there's wonderful, wonderful literature on this period about our pulpit diplomacy.
Mm.
And so I was thinking we always pretend that we're working for the greater good, that kind of Boy Scout.
Peace, order, and good government.
Yes. Well, and how we're really, when you really look at what was happening during the Cuban Missile Crisis, we had no choice in anything. And Diefenbaker was kind of our last nationalist, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Pearson came in and pretended otherwise.
So Diefenbaker is a character in the book.
Yeah.
And there are a few other real life characters.
Yes.
I'm curious in terms of like creating sort of ancillary characters or people to go around these true historic figures. Like how much thought did you give to like how you would work that out, right? Or like sort of veracity or like making things sync up with like, was that person in Ottawa when they're supposedly having this conversation?
Yeah, it's a great question. And it's always a problem for any of us who are writing historical fiction. And sometimes you do have to compromise. I think that I stayed true to the chronology, and that portrait of Diefenbaker, as odd as it is towards the end of the book, is verbatim, a lot of that stuff, from a book by Ogden Nash, great book. Mr. Jones himself, Emmett Jones, was inspired by Herbert Norman,
mm-hmm.
who was a real-life diplomat who did have a rough time with the RCMP, accusing him of being a communist. So the stuff around the McCarthy era has been really well documented.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a lot of stuff about General MacArthur that I had to get permission for because he did say those crazy things. It's bizarre how crazy it really is.
So permission like from his estate, is that?
No, from the text, the history.
Oh, okay.
Even though it's history, you have to get permission from the historian.
Interesting.
Which is pretty weird.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you mentioned that you read spy thrillers and stuff growing up.
Yeah.
And I'm curious about the seeds of this book. Like, had you always wanted to write something like this? Or was there, like, did you discover the story of Herbert Norman and want to sort of fictionalize it? Like,
It's both, Michael. Yeah, it's interesting for any of us because I think we're always writing books of origin. And I grew up on 1950s novels, say, Well, certainly the Fleming books and some of the more bizarre, sexual and violent American, Robert Ruark, for example, a real sexist, fabulous, horrible drunk. And that was where, I mean, I was very young reading that stuff. And so that, I think when we're writing books of origin, we're always going back to what it is that drove us to this life of devoting ourselves to writing, and we go back to the books. So before that, the book before this one was inspired by Mutiny on the Bounty, which was another book that meant everything to me as a little kid.
Right.
Before that, it was ghost stories. So I think we're always trying to diagnose our love.
To kind of like trace things back to, yeah, to books that meant...
That made you, made me. Like, I grew up on that.
Right.
And the politics during that period, this is my history, and the Kennedys were... the most glamorous thing on earth. And the merging, I thought Kennedy ran Canada,
right,
quite rightly, when I was very little. And so all of this was a, sort of a telling of my upbringing.
Right. So speaking of that, is Lenore kind of your proxy?
Yes.
Okay, because like timeline-wise,
yes,
you know, you'd be about kind of going,
yes,
through the same things. And of course, like,
yes,
we do get, you know, inside Lenore's head.
Yeah.
It's not just that she's like, you know, Emmett and Suzanne's child and, you know,
yes,
she's subject to the action. She's actually a participant in some ways and,
yeah,
and particularly an observer.
Yeah.
And then there's like the stuff, you know, like her questioning, like ducking under your chair in school during sort of the
yeah,
A-bomb era. And I can remember watching like videos of the duck and cover stuff, the Tommy,
yeah,
Turtle, and I figured like that had to have been actually shown in your classrooms.
Yeah, that's what we did. And I remember driving walking home from Grosvenor School at lunch, because my mother would be home at lunch, and thinking the sky was going to fall.
Mm-hmm.
And I went, yeah, Lenore is very much, I've never written such a personal character before.
So did you kind of tap into some of like your memories of like how you felt growing up,
yes,
in that period?
Yes, it was very much a, that is the most personal, personal writing I've ever done, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Less disguised.
Right, and I suppose like that observant nature that Lenore exhibits is something that, in my experience, authors exhibit, right? Like you're really taking in everything around you because it's,
yeah,
fuel for the creative fire.
Yeah, and that kind of sense of distrust and alienation.
Yeah, and wariness, I think, right? Like,
yes,
you're not accepting truths.
No, and you're always overhearing. I think kids and certain types of adults are always working from hearsay. So we're always overhearing history, and we're overhearing our lives from the, say, a little kid standing upstairs overhearing the conversation of adults.
Right, like
so
hanging over
happens.
The banister, or
yeah,
like sitting on the staircase.
Yeah, and that's not just from the 50s and 60s.
Oh, no, still, that continues to this day. I know that
yeah,
for a fact.
Yeah. You know where kids are watching and they're wondering what the hell they are because they're overhearing what the adults are saying, he or she.
Yeah.
Find out who you are.
So then in writing Lenore, like... Were you, I mean, because she's obviously going through different experiences than you did as a child, right? Like, I mean, there's the stuff that you would have experienced in school that she experiences in school. But the home life and this, you know, suspicion by the RCMP and her dad being kind of taken away occasionally, these kinds of things. Like, how do you create sort of a new voice out of your experiences and then what you're writing her as? Like,
yeah,
did you find that there's like a way to balance kind of what you feel is true to what you experienced with like veracity of what her lived experience is in this case?
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot of fun. That's the making stuff up part. And that's the huge pleasure when you get sort of hydroplaning. You're actually fantasizing. You're sitting at your computer fantasizing.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's sort of that degree of, and all writers always talk about this, and it works for me, is that method acting thing that you go there and you see it and you see what the light is and you experience that. We had, when I was a kid, I think he was a professor of math, probably here at the University of Manitoba, who had been kicked out of the States for so-called communist sympathies.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and that was when, you know, I was in elementary school and they were sort of my friends and they were kind of geeky and they were weird. And I found that very interesting that communism, they had cats and we had dogs. And I thought communists had cats. And so it was very, very personal. And it was in the fabric of our lives. They had Eskimo art, which I thought was communist. And they were more intellectual and more experimental in their living. So there was, and then when I went to theater school here, it was downtown central Winnipeg, and that's where I met at 12 my first communists, because they came from the North End and their parents were North European communists.
Right.
Still, you know, even after Stalin was busted.
Yeah.
By Khrushchev in 56, I guess it was. Even after, there were still people I knew lots of kids who, young kids, we were all studying theater, but they called themselves communists.
Right.
So it was there, it was present.
So you're observing this climate at the time. How much of that sort of remembrance of the adult world did you draw on to create sort of the climate?
Well, it was really palpable and very sensual, I think. It was... the way women would look and the smell of perfume and the kinds of dresses and their relationship with men. Addictive, I think, because they didn't have their own money, or if they did, that was channeled through the men. Summers at the lake, I drew a lot on. I went to Blue Sea Lake to research it, but I drew on my memories of being a little kid. We had a boat and we rented a cottage at Lake of the Woods. So a lot of that, I kept coming back to a lake environment as the home center. Mm-hmm. So all of that kind of sensuality of bathing suits and heat and sex, like the sexuality of that kind of sexuality, and that's always interested me, the relationship between sexuality and politics. They're very, very intertwined in our lives.
Right, and there's... like a wooing process,
yeah.
In terms of convincing someone to come to your side,
yeah.
That is there's a parallel to, yeah. Like,
and I think addiction. The 50s, right from the war, the Second World War through, there was a lot of addiction. There was a lot of alcoholism among the upper middle class where I grew up. My dad was a successful lawyer, and. There was a lot of liquor, and there were a lot of people who came out of the... It was also my father among them. He was in the Navy. He was a very brilliant and wonderful, wonderful, wonderful man. But there was a lot of post-traumatic stress disorder.
That's what I was going to ask about, because Emmett, the titular Mr. Jones,
yeah.
is clearly suffering PTSD,
yeah.
right? Like, I mean, right from the get-go, we get the sense that
yeah.
what he's seen and what he's experienced
yeah.
is hanging over him.
Yeah.
And I was curious, like, did you do like research on psychology of PTSD to kind of get it, or did you just
I grew up with it, yeah.
Yeah.
And so I'm studying it now for another book about the Vietnam War, because it's more, the language is applicable. But at that time, it was more issues of addiction. The women were addicted too. Suzanne is an addict, Emmett's wife. She behaves addictively. Whatever she does, her photography, her loves are addictions. And I think that was really pretty well sums up the kind of social fabric that I grew up with.
Right. So he's called Mr. Jones, and the title's Mr. Jones. And I mean, that seems like a Mr. Smith, right? Like, in terms
yes.
of just so like vanilla, and you can see him being like a mid-level bureaucrat, right? Like
yeah.
Mr. Jones. But the first name Emmett, I was curious about. I mean, I'm always curious about, because you're inventing these characters and then you're
yeah.
naming them,
yeah.
sort of the idea behind the name. Like the Emmett that I know, there was an Emmett who was like a rebel in Ireland, a famous rebel. So, you know, it's a relatively unique name versus Mr. Jones, right?
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
So the decisions in terms of naming, I'm always curious, and
yeah.
I'd love to know kind of what...
Well, it's sort of musicality. I mean, there was an Emmett, there was a communist who's, I've sort of forgotten, that almost made me give up on the name Emmett, but I like E's. I love double M's and double T's. Two syllables and one. I gave him, his last name was Whitaker for a long time into the book, until I realized that Jones gave him that notion too, as the Bob Dylan song too, of a drone in a system, what's his name? Frank Mills Wright? Frank Wright Mills? Frank Wright Mills, the sociologist.
Right, okay, yeah.
Writing
yeah.
about the white collar drones and Power Elite was one of the names of his books. So I used sort of a vaguely distinctive first name. And then the drone name, where he could become invisible, and he marries up into so-called Ottawa people.
Right.
So I liked that problem that was presented to his wife's family, that it's a Jones. So they assume that it's a hyphenated name, that it would be Emmett Jones.
Right, yeah.
So it played into the thing about class.
And their kind of expectations of a yeah. person. And as for like his class, I mean, he comes from relatively reasonably well-off background, that, you know, his father's able to afford, you know, two homes to manage yeah. in Japan. But he's kind of adrift, right? I mean, that's ultimately
yes.
what
he's
his
orphaned.
Story is. He's by himself.
Yes.
Whether he's with other people or not.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
the decision to kind of create, I mean, obviously in terms of like having the background in Japanese, it makes it easy for him to then, you know, work on the South Asian portfolio and stuff mm-hmm. like that. But choosing to have him, you know, grow up in Japan, and then, you know, you are always a gaijin in Japan,
mm-hmm. yes.
You know, unless
yes.
you are Japanese.
Yes.
Everyone else is outside of that. And then, of course, coming back to Canada, then he becomes an outsider in his native country as well, because of his experience of growing up in a vastly different culture.
Yes.
And it was that just to kind of like unmoor him further?
Well, it was modeled, again, Emmett was modeled on Herbert Norman, who was who grew up in Japan. His father was a missionary there. And one of the things that happened during the McCarthy era, which led to the disaster of Vietnam, was that there was such distrust of anyone who knew anything about Asia.
Mm.
There was a purposeful dummying down. And so
we've heard that before.
It happened with Herbert Norman, and so I made it happen to Emmett Jones, that his very knowledge of Japanese and Asian culture made him further suspect.
In the close of the book, you do cite a book about Herbert Norman and several other books about sort of spycraft mm-hmm. and stuff like that. I'm curious, like, how much research did you do before, like, crafting this story? Or was it kind of something that you had the idea for the story and then you looked for sort of supporting material to kind of build out the world?
Well, when you're researching any kind of, I think historical fiction is for me, and I don't think it's unusual, is that I first was inspired by a biography of Herbert Norman. And he committed suicide, and it was really shocking to me. And I became obsessed by him. And I went to Japan to research his origins, where he was. And then I became obsessed with the notion of suicide and of spying. And oddly enough, there are autobiographies of spies. That contradiction
mm-hmm.
is incredibly interesting. So I read a lot of autobiographies of spies. And then I realized, what the hell are they? And I realized that spies are writers. So then when that clicked, I knew him better. I thought, well, I'm him. I get it. That kind of arrogance, that secret knowledge, that kind of thing that writers have of manifest destiny, that really what you're really doing isn't what you're doing at the moment. That's very much like writers.
Mm.
Yeah. So I read, and then you write, and then you go back and do more research, and then you write another draft, and then you do more research, and so on until you want to throw up.
So, I mean, are you the type of person who, like, wrote this straight through, or were there, like, portions that you wrote out of sequence and then kind of, like, reintegrated?
Yeah, I went through a lot of drafts. I think it was really trying to articulate. I was fascinated by the challenge of trying to write a mystery. I've always been afraid of plot, so of course you go towards what you're most afraid of, and then to try and write where the reader, you're trying to lay enough clues that when they go back, they see that you have a valid path, but they haven't seen it till they get there. So a periodic structure. And then that took a lot of drafts to see, and I wrote many drafts until I felt I had something. And then I started working with Bethany Gibson, a brilliant editor who's now living in Ottawa. She was then in Fredericton, and I still work with her. I'll give her the next my next book, too. And because she is sort of my mirror, and she would help me diagnose where it was getting, where there wasn't enough, there weren't enough clues, or where it bogged down, or where characters would. It's tricky when you have a character like Emmett Jones, who in some ways is damaged, that a damaged character can sometimes draw the energy out of a story. And so I had to, I needed her to help me with that, to keep his vitality, therefore the vitality of the story.
Right, because one of the things I actually bookmarked early on is like he, you know, in talking to his friend about, you know, going to Russia and, you know, oh, maybe I will, that in fact he says, you know, oh, where is it here? Emmett wanted a world without any kind of state at all. No Stalin, no Truman, no generals and prime ministers, no ministers of war. That he's essentially become like kind of almost a nihilist or an anarchist in some sense, that like he wants to tear everything down.
Well, in a way, that's kind of the origins of revolutionary communism in its most ideal state. And so there's a wonderful book, Carew Hunt. I just bought it again. I had it out of the library, and it was used by, it was written by a very, very, very brilliant philosopher scholar to help attack, to help the West attack and fight communism. But it's actually, in many ways, an apology for communism. And it defines that as one of the ideals. It is actually, in some of its respects, ultimate libertarianism. Yeah, and I think in Marx too. That's always attracted me in all my novels, of this ideal of the human freedom that was often called communism in the 1919 strike too. They had the similar millennial vision of a revolution. I was fascinated by the notion that we could have a revolution and completely revolutionize everything, all our relations.
Right, there's like a self-actualization to the the process, which is especially interesting because then Emmett becomes, you know, like a mid-level bureaucrat and is like a cog in an existing machine, which is like the antithesis of kind of what he wants to do in some ways.
Well, it's so interesting with spying because you often take your antithesis as your disguise.
Mm-hmm. So, Suzanne, you mentioned, you know, his wife. I'm curious, like, did you draw any historical figure or, like, fictional figure for her? Or?
No, she was more the women that my mother's generation. These are, Emmett and Suzanne are of my parents' generation. And not my parents. Certainly, I think that kind of a style and... her beauty, that is almost her disguise, is her beauty. And she's an artist and, as I said, an addict. I think I just knew her right away. Maybe in a way, too, they got their style from James Bond movies and from Jackie Kennedy. So their figures, their way of dress... They wore stockings at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, you know, pumps... for dinner, smoked and drank a lot.
Right. Like, I mean, she's obviously, like, she's grown up in a wealthy household and there's expectations of what, like, a woman of her, you know, stature and background is expected to do. But at the same time, she kind of, like, pushes back against that and, you know, pursuing the photography or pursuing Emmett and, or even John Norfield, who we haven't talked about, but we're going to move on to in a second. But that she, like... There's like a sort of naivete and like a knowing that she kind of plunges into these things, like kind of like without regards to the kind of the consequences, but knowing full well that it's not necessarily going to end up. Right.
She kind of commits herself. And I think this was something out of my own life where you leave your class. And I had to do that as well as say, 17 years old. You have to jump out of your class if you're going to escape it. And she actually gets almost blighted by fall. She falls in love in a way that is, like I was looking at the Psyche, Cupid Psyche myth in there, where there's almost like a blindness. She's so blinded by her love, it becomes her addiction. She becomes an addict when she sort of falls in love so thoroughly. And I have known women to whom that happened, and they don't recover.
Right.
So it's a very interesting phenomenon. And
yeah.
I've seen it happen. It's murder.
So John Northfield, who I mentioned. So the book starts, you know, at the lake, and they're like meeting with his higher up, Bill Masters, and he's like, "So tell me about John Northfield." And so this is kind of like the third man kind of thing, right? Where it's like, oh, you know, let's back the train up. Friend of both of theirs in college who has communist ties, and so this is why Emmett is then suspicious as a government worker that, you know, he has ties to a communist. But the relationship between John, Suzanne, and Emmett, I'm curious, like, was, like, Jules et Jim, like, the film, like, kind of an inspiration? Because there's that, like, weird sort of, like, love triangle going on, like, this relationship where both of them are in love with the same woman, but there's, like, a, like, fraternity and sort of combative relationship between John and Emmett as well. And that really seemed to, like, echo that movie.
Yeah, I don't really like Truffaut's movies,
although oh, really?
I kind of liked, but I hadn't thought of that. But I think the affiliations between men and the way that homosexuality was still illegal, and it was used by the state to control people, to accuse someone of homosexuality. I had a cousin who committed suicide in the 60s for that reason. So how lethal and how dangerous homoerotic feelings were then, and how compartmentalized men had to be, and how dangerous their feelings could be to themselves, and what a weapon that was against them. So, and I think I liked the way they really, truly, they fall in love too. Emmett falls in love with both Suzanne and John. And falling in love is so interesting because it's sort of like it's a physical, that kind of love. It's not one that grows. It's a searing first experience that doesn't ever leave you, and it's leaves these scars. So he becomes kind of scarred by the way he falls in love.
Right. He like it's a pang to him the way he feels about these things.
And he's generous. I think Emmett grows. Like he loves Suzanne in a way that has to grow. And she loves Emmett in a way that actually has to grow, whereas her love for both of their loves for John is one of those kind of scars, that kind of love.
Right. It's frozen in time, and that's like the college
that
thing.
That Zoom
like,
thing that doesn't ever go out,
When you're a young adult before you've kind of like realized what adulthood is about in some sense.
Yeah.
So Morton, who is the RCMP officer who's kind of pursuing Emmett, I'm curious, like in your research with Herbert Norman and stuff, like was there a figure like Norman who was, you know, in pursuit? Like, cause he has some agency in terms of, like, he seems like he's really into this, but at the same time, clearly there's, like, higher-ups in terms of, like, the U.S. telling Canada to, like, lean on and investigate these people.
Yeah, well, say with the Herbert Norman tragedy, his life ended in 1956, the RCMP did give his papers to the FBI. I was thinking of Mararar. He inspired a lot of the issues that sort of transnational betrayal. And the fact that Canada, in a way I felt, I feel more hopeful now, but when I was writing it too, it was the Harper years, and I felt that this false, we're not defended by our country. Fred Rose died in Europe. He was expelled from Canada and they took away his citizenship because he was a communist. So I think that we live with a sort of thin delusion that the RCMP are going to protect us, that we actually do have our own police force. I don't think we do. I know we don't. I did talk to a couple of RCMP officers about their kind of attitude towards money and power and their freedom within the force to make sure that I wasn't being completely off base with him. And he became kind of fascinating. I cut a lot of stuff with Morton. I had a huge section that was all about Morton. I became totally obsessed with him. Mm. He had his own marriage, and I had his kids. And
You kind of allude to it. I mean, he has like kind of the, like what, five kids, I think, is there's like a reference to his, the size of his family. And then he becomes like business partners with Dr. Kimura. Like there's some, there's obviously some stuff going on. And you do hint at like these other sort of tertiary characters having lives outside of like how they impact with Emmett Jones.
The manhood was really, womanhood and manhood in the post-war period is so fascinating. And the men, I don't even know if, I can't remember if it's in the book now, but the RCMP officer Morton buys a boat. I don't know if that's even in the book now.
I don't recall that.
They had a good time. There was a, the James Bond ideal to men too was very compelling. And they had a way of being witty and buying things and having money and using their power and very, very much more confident about their right not to participate in child rearing or home caring. Mm. So they had a lot of lonely kind of power. And Morton was one of those men. He was sort of modeled in a way a lot of the men that I grew up with, my dad's friends and to some extent my father.
Right, and he, unlike Emmett, he doesn't seem to have like kind of like the self-doubt or, you know.
No, that kind of
he's
bully.
Not adrift, right? Like he seems to know exactly what he wants and how to get it.
Yeah, he's a boxer.
Yeah. Well, the book is Mr. Jones, Margaret Sweatman. Thanks very much for coming in and
Thank
sitting and talking about
me.
It.
Thanks for talking to me.